Our next speaker this morning is David Foster from Harvard University. David is the PI of the Harvard Forest LGER program, and he'll speak to centuries of social ecological change in the deciduous forest of eastern North America.
I'd like to accomplish a couple of things this morning. First and foremost, I would hope that I would leave you with a sense of the excitement that is ranging through the ecological community and certainly the long-term ecological research community for the directions that the ISSE is heading. And I'll hope to illustrate that with a number of examples which play up on the importance of incorporating a historical perspective, i.e. long-term, both back in time and forward in time. I'd like to start off with this little note, which comes from a paper I wrote after giving a keynote address at the Landscape Ecology meetings in 1997. That was 10 years after the Harvard Forest and the Lakio LTER had written successful proposals. And the point that I was trying to make was that in sitting around and discussing the important drivers of change historically in our regions and currently in these two regions, there was no question that humans were probably at the top of everybody's list. In fact, we sat in the forest in at Lakio, looked out across the landscape and could see San Juan in the distance, and people said, that is the driver of change. But through a series of discussions, we came to the conclusion that our ecological colleagues who would be reviewing our proposals and the National Science Foundation, which would be funding the effort, would not accept humans as legitimate focus for ecological study. And so grantsmanship won out, and as you can see, the focus for the Lakio LTER at its outset was all in the intact forest looking at natural process. Now, one of the important things about that constraint is it also constrained us from looking historically at our landscapes, because there are very few landscapes, and certainly in Puerto Rico or the Caribbean or in New England, that haven't been entirely transformed by human activity. And so we were constrained in a major way, which makes this program that you're seeing talked about this morning a tremendous breath of fresh air. What I'd like to do today is to review from the perspective of both history and modern activities, why this is such a nice and compelling framework. I'd like to give a couple of examples from research efforts that are going on in the region, in New England especially, but I'd also like to talk about the application of this information to policy, to management, to conservation activities, and I'd also like to underscore the way that bringing people in as legitimate subjects for ecological study, incorporating the history of landscapes and the incredibly complex feedbacks that have gone on through time, make for really compelling educational and outreach types of products. So another diagram similar to the ones that you've seen, but I'd like to point out the two circled items on here to draw your attention to those. The details of the presses and the pulses and the ecosystem services we'll talk a little bit about. But the important thing is that this framework, once we started thinking about it at our site and others in our region started thinking about it, provided a very natural way for us to link together regionally and study big, broad, important processes that affect us all. And so this is a wonderful framework, not only for site-based work, but for regional work, cross-regional work, inter-site kinds of studies. So it's very flexible, it's very compelling. The other thing that we decided in thinking about our region and the processes that we're interested in, is that there's an incredible historical depth to these processes. There's a legacy from past activities, past dynamics in every system that carry forward to the present. And so we came up with a modified kind of loop diagram that has temporal depth to it. It's been coined many things, but I really like historical slinky. Basically, what it does is it shows or tries to show in a compelling way that all ecosystems, all human systems, have history. And that history matters for the present, and it matters into the future. And so we can relate what we learn from mid-Holocene dynamics of forest systems to what we're seeing in the landscape today. And there's a connectedness among all of these events and all of these processes and all of these times. Let me just give a couple of examples. At the bottom, we have a suite of broad climatic or geological drivers of climate change. And these are well understood, and they translate into long-term changes in vegetation, composition, and ecosystem processes globally. But in many cases, as shown at the top, we see abrupt and sudden shifts in vegetation composition or in ecosystem processes that don't correspond at all to some of these broad changes. And so clearly we have the press of long-term drivers, and then we have the possibility of the overlay of individual pulses of disturbance events, in the case of New England vegetation, leading to a mid-Holocene change in just a few hundred years. And these are two different sites, from a great abundance of hemlock and a great abundance of oak, major drops, as a result of what we interpret to be significant drought episodes, in some cases accompanied by fire. So clearly the press pulse framework for research makes a lot of sense back in time, as it does in our modern studies. But so does the compelling notion of thinking of people in this system as well. There are three maps from the state of Connecticut showing the distribution of archaeological sites over time, showing that the greatest density and basically the flourishing of the population in prehistory in this region occurred during this period of very rapid vegetation change, and during this period in which, for example, hemlock was at its lowest abundance in the last 8,000 years. Now, is this a flourishing because of climate change and vegetation composition? And to what extent do people, as major agents of fire ignition, relate to the changes that we see in vegetation? Clearly unraveling the direct and indirect impacts of climate, vegetation composition, people, human activity, subsistence base, are all part of this kind of framework and design and discussion that we're talking about in the modern setting. Another example. Ecologists are greatly interested with a range of exotic invasive pest pathogens, plants, organisms in our environment and the role that they play. Here's one example, which is an important current driver of change in the eastern United States. It's the introduction of the Asian hemlock woolly adelgid, which is spreading through the range of hemlock and could effectively reduce it to an insignificant component across its entire range. It's a process and a phenomenon that we've been studying since the early 1990s, both because of its significance to our forest, but as a wonderful example, albeit a terribly unfortunate one, of a kind of natural elimination of a dominant species, which in many ways is a keystone or major species controlling a range of terrestrial and aquatic ecological processes. So it's a wonderful opportunity for us to both study something that's fundamentally important ecologically, but also then to pass off that information for application to land managers and so on. There's a suite of sites that we're interacting with across the eastern U.S. who are working on similar things, and so there's some very interesting interregional processes and opportunities. Now, when we first got into this, we thought that this was going to be, we could basically approach it as a pure ecological process. Watching this invasive insect spread through the landscape, killing trees, eliminating this dominant species, and watching ecosystem response. Just being people who grew up living in New England, understanding the importance of people and landscapes. But we didn't take into account the human response. 50% of the forests in southern New England are logged at the time of first arrival or before the arrival of this insect to the forest, because people are anticipating the impact that the insect is going to have, and so they act first. So what that's led us into is a much more robust, much more comprehensive suite of studies that very nicely fit into this framework that's been discussed this morning. It's got history, because the history of each of these forests controls very much its current composition and to some extent the way it's going to respond either to logging or to the removal of the mortality of hemlock by the insect. It certainly has a socio-ecological component, because you can't talk about these forests as natural forests because they have people written all over them. It's got wonderful opportunities for site-based, inter-site, and regional activity, and of course, it goes beyond just the terrestrial realm and incorporates aquatic responses as well. It also provides information which is critically needed by landowners and by land managers, which for some reason is not being provided by many of the more policy relevant agencies and organizations that exist. So basically you have a group of ecologists who got into the study for its fundamental insights, who are actually turning around and providing to land managers and landowners much of the basic information that they need to know how to respond to this insect. The third example I want to provide is one that really looks pretty comprehensively at and is the backdrop for all the work that we undertake at the Harvard Forest LTER site, and most people in New England take into account with their work. And this is a story which actually goes well beyond New England and encompasses much of the eastern United States, and it's the deforestation and reforestation of the landscape as a result of the spread of agriculture first throughout the East, and the movement of that agriculture to the Midwest and West with the recovery of the forest as agriculture declined and the growing population moved into industrial centers. Looking at the population curve, which is this black curve that starts at the lower left and goes up to the top, so this is the growth of the population, you can see that this is a complex socio-ecological phenomenon, that human behavior has changed fundamentally in the middle of that dynamic, allowing the forest to recover at the same time that the population is continuing to grow. You also notice out to the right that the dynamic has shifted within the last 20 years. For the first time in the last 150 years, we're having a drop in forest cover. So this is the backdrop, and the right shows the consequences of this process, so that all the forest ecosystems, all the aquatic systems that we study are embedded in this landscape that have been transformed by humans. Now, why is that important? It's important because these, for lots of different reasons, ecologically and socially. But one of the reasons it's important globally is because these forests are rapidly growing. and sequestering carbon, storing carbon as they're producing more wood. And that wood, as we just heard a comment about, is sitting out in these forests, and some of it is productive timber, some of it is potential waste wood, but right now it's an unused resource that's sitting out there that is providing global benefit by reducing the rate of increase in atmospheric CO2. This historic dynamic has also been associated with a phenomenal transformation in habitat and in human attitudes towards wildlife, which has led to this corresponding shift in major wildlife species and groups over time. So the mid-19th century was a period in which the eastern United States saw a flourishing of open land species, of birds, insects, small mammals, and other organisms. At the same time that there was a dearth of large native mammals, which had mostly been driven regionally extinct by overhunting. In the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen a remarkable shift in that, with those open land species becoming the least abundant, most threatened, highest conservation priorities in the region, interestingly, at the same time that native larger mammals have come back in phenomenal numbers. Now, one can anticipate in this a tremendous socio-ecological interaction that is occurring. We already know about it in terms of deer in the suburbs and their impacts on forests. We're certainly experiencing it in many places with beavers and other animals, coyotes and so on. But when you have a bear population in Massachusetts, which is increasing at 10 to 12% a year, and a moose population, which is increasing at about the same rate, one can see that we're headed for a very interesting ecological human collision. But I'd like to move beyond just kind of research emphasis and this structure that we're talking about within the LTER program as really a context for more, a context for conservation and then a context for education. People respond to history, and they respond to history that is both natural and cultural. And so one of the things that this graph does is it captivates a general audience when they look and they recognize that the eastern United States, and New England in particular, is an unusual place because there are very few places in the world where you get a second chance to determine what you're going to do with nature. In New England, the first chance, forests were cut down, the wood was burned up, and the landscape was converted to farmland. It's what I call a soft deforestation, because as soon as that farming practice declined, the forest came sweeping right back. We now have this phenomenal extent of forest cover, and we're now going through a second, much harder deforestation, one that will certainly be permanent because the structures that we're putting down, the surfaces that we're putting down, are hard and meant to be permanent. So this has been seized upon as an interesting motivator for discussion about conservation and about attitudes towards nature. We ourselves have generated a publication that points this out and then basically scopes out different scenarios for the future. And part of the research that goes on in our research program is developing the basic information and the modeling capabilities to look at the consequences of these different scenarios into the future. And that's something that will need to be collective among all the regional LTER sites, both because it's a fundamental interest and because the collective ability to do that kind of work resides in all of the regional sites. In this paper and in the discussions that we have and in the research program that we're talking about, we're really focusing in on ecological or ecosystem services, what we call basic infrastructure. And the reason we use that term is because general audiences are filled with people who are used to paying for infrastructure. They pay for infrastructure in their homes, they pay taxes for infrastructure. Ecosystem service is a kind of fuzzy concept. But when you talk about delivering real products for nature and for people in natural systems, water and air and recreational opportunities, as an investment in the future, an investment in infrastructure for society, people understand. And rather than getting really complex, the ecosystem service that we are focusing in on, and actually do a substantial amount of research on, basic research in terms of water dynamics in the region, looks at something that, at least in Massachusetts, everybody can relate to. We have an artificial reservoir in the center of the state that produces water for 40% of the population. That reservoir sits in a watershed that the state has purchased back in the 1930s and has been adding to over time, in which now 85% of the forested land is, that forested watershed, is permanently protected from any kind of development. As a consequence, the water that goes from that reservoir goes directly into the taps in Boston and is unfiltered and untreated. EPA grants a waiver to Normal treatment plant because of the high quality of the water. The treatment plant currently is valued at $750 million for construction, and then you have operation and maintenance. So a very simple ecosystem service that relates directly to the forests that also provide incredible other values to this population. So this is a simple story in which is all kinds of embedded interesting science, looking at evapotranspiration, forest water use, hydrology over time, and so on and so forth, that also is a compelling argument, obviously, for land protection and then for looking at alternative managements of that. So then also thinking about the socio-ecological framework that we have embedded in this ISSE as something that can that people can relate to in other ways, that we can use to bring people into our forests, into our natural environment, to get interested in it, because there's a big story in it. There's a story of people and dynamics and historical change. So we're trying to develop at Harvard in the Natural History Museum an exhibit. It'd be about a 2,000 square foot permanent exhibit with a separate exhibit out at the Harvard Forest LTER site, where we also have a museum, that will introduce people to their forest in this much more complex way that we're talking about in this room, as an ecological system that does directly interact with people, that provides benefits to people, that has changed as a result of people, and that has changed as a result of changes in people's attitudes. So this exhibit would have a corresponding public lecture series. It's going to produce a suite of educational materials for K-12 teachers and classes, curriculum materials. We hope to produce one of the Schoolyard LTER volumes that will highlight some of the major stories coming out of this. I personally would like to use this as an opportunity to write a general readership volume that tells the historical story of this landscape and the modern ecological story in a way that conveys to people what this landscape provides to them as a means of motivating them to operate in it differently than they are at present. It also has a variety of other spin-off possibilities in terms of getting people from the museum out into the landscape to different sites that we run, that the Nature Conservancy runs, that the state runs in its forests and parks and so on. So looking back over 20 years of the development of the LTER program, it really is quite remarkable to see the shifts that have taken place in ecology, the shifts that have taken place in the National Science Foundation, and the shifts that have taken place in terms of scientists' attitudes and interests. When I watch the talks that are going on this morning and seeing a group of scientists that go well beyond the basic ecological process to talk about not only the social dimensions, but then the handoff from that to management and policy, it really is extraordinary. And it's a phenomenal time to be an ecologist and a phenomenal opportunity to do something that really can translate to a larger population and get things done. Thanks.
Let's see, we'll have time for one or possibly two questions if there is interest.
Somewhat more of a comment. Something that's striking me more and more as I listen to all these talks is, as an anthropologist, full disclosure, socio-ecological here is largely ecologists recognizing that humans have an important impact, and I think that's great. But I also wonder, I mean, we have one talk by an economist, but especially as you get into things like trying to understand in more detail how humans are having an impact and how different groups of humans have different kinds of impacts and why, I think it would be interesting to try to move into having anthropologists and sociologists as part of some of these groups. And perhaps they are, and it just hasn't been obvious to me, but I think that would be an interesting next step.
Yeah, so there was a couple of slides I didn't show, and one of them was going to be one that listed a group of other people who were involved, but they do include archaeologists and anthropologists and environmental historians and economists. And we do actually, certainly many of the sites that you've seen, we are largely the ecologists talking, but I think we're talking in a decidedly different way than we would have talked 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And a large measure of that is due to the fact that we have so strongly encompassed representing these other disciplines in this research. So you would get a different but related suite of talks from our archaeologists and our historians and our economists.
Gotcha.
But they would fit together.
One comment on that is that there are two lead PIs in LTR sites that are social sciences. And actually, one of them, Ted Gregson from COWIDA, has been very actively involved in this planning process and took over as lead PI of one of the more, if you will, traditional LTR sites, the Forest Service Watershed site with a very long history. So yeah, I think the six people here are certainly representative of the efforts in LTR, but there is that involvement formally.
Thanks. Part of this is a pitch for additional funding to provide the continuity of that effort, because that does not exist. But if it did exist, it would become a much larger.
Thank you, Dave.